Worldwide basis, how does cancer compare to malaria? At one time, 10 years ago, I'd have seen the moving answer. At present, malaria is less than that cancer. And finally, item 7 here deals with the question of brain drain, which is significant, but it's pretty, for the U.S. and Latin America, very dramatic. A couple years ago, when the total amount of money from the U.S. that was going to Latin America to support health development, and anyway, going to support medical food, going to support building of hospitals, immaterial of the source of the fund, the method of delivering funding through AID or other kinds of formats, the total value of the money that left here was equal to the 300 physicians that came here each year, not to train, but to stay here permanently. The project, two people came here for a couple years to train and go home. Some of those people came here permanently. It was about 300 a year. I'm not sure that today it's the same as 4 years ago, but still a high number. Okay, on to then the first page of this package. And this is my effort to express the relative importance of these different diseases in terms of mortality for the 16 diseases above the horizontal line here and morbidity diseases below. Each of these diseases has a impact in terms of morbidity and mortality. Each of them has prevalence and incidence, but my reason for leaving out the other data and filling on this page is to simplify it, but you recognize that all 24 entities here have a prevalence, incidence, and mortality rate. This is deaths per year, and let me just review with you the meaning of prevalence and incidence. Who wants to approach that? Okay.
Okay. Incidence, I think, is the sort of number of cases at a given point in time, or let's see. It'd be the cumulative, yeah, cumulative.
How many cases have occurred in whatever time period we defined, a week, a month, a year? What's prevalent is what's going on at this time. Except that prevalence can be looked at as a period of prevalence or point prevalence. You could say, at this moment in time, how many people have colds in this room? Or you could say, in the past week or month, how many people have had colds? When you say it the latter way, it's almost approaching an incident statement, but nevertheless, clear distinction is between point prevalence, how many cases at this moment in time versus how many occurred in the past moment of time. Then there's another aspect to this, quite right to speak of absolute numbers called an incidence of prevalence, although it's real enough. We can say that for this country, there are X specific number of cases of new cases of tuberculosis. But both incidence of prevalence are meant to be rates, meant to be expressed as per unit of population. Again, it's arbitrary what unit you want to use, but they should be preferably expressed as rates. Okay, item number one, the antiretrovirals, estimated causes of death, 10 million. And obviously the impact there, mostly on children. Half of those deaths are in children under the age of 5. What is it that kills these kids? Is it the bacterial pathogens like typhoid or cholera and amoeboviruses? Vascular dysentery. Well, cholera at its worst, and as you know, there are waves, have been the last 200 years, interesting chart for the movement of cholera from place to place in the world, and it remains endemic in certain folks that like India, Indonesia. But in the worst years, during this century, no more than 500,000 people have been estimated to have died from cholera. Well, 500,000 cases of cholera don't explain but a 20th of 10 million causes of death. I put cholera first because it has the greatest impact. Typhoid estimate is like 50,000. Amoebiasis, less than that. Vascular dysentery, less than that. Well, if I can't account for more than, say, 1 million, 2 million, then what is going on? Well, we all probably know the new significance of the enteropathogenic cold form. This plus the new enteroviruses, the real viruses, dual viruses, we don't know the latter just yet what their significance is, their impact. As far as enteropathogens, we know a little bit more than we knew 10 years ago, 5 years ago. I forgot to bring in the paper that Fred Starrett and I published in JAMA a year ago. When the VBDs children came through here 2 years ago, Fred Starrett from the Letterman and I, participated in the program of health care for the children and an effort to appraise what kind of diseases, or disease entities they were bringing in. Let me see if I can just roughly recall what happened. 50% of the children, 2/3 of the children were infants under 18 months. Of those, half had diarrhea. We isolated so-called enteropathogenic agents from, about 180 enteropathogenic E. coli organisms. Borrelia isolated, three Shigella, no amoeba, and yeah, a couple still no. In other words, the children, about 400 children, from 400 children, we isolated 200 pathogens, well, of which Shigella, Salmonella, Peyronie, five of the children. The others were the so-called enteropathogen organisms, as by the criteria, the old criteria of serologic typing. That criteria is almost certainly no longer valid. To put it this way, there are about 200-300 enteropathogenic serotypes. Is there a better figure than that? That just tells you how hard it is to run a longitudinal study on diarrheal diseases in the tropics if you're going to isolate coliforms, salmonella, and then go through the process of typing 800 and 200 respectively. Which is what you have to do if you're going to follow, if you're going to determine the impact of diarrhea on young children in the developing country, you get a cohort of 100 and then follow them in the course of a year with multiple stool examinations. That's why this process is so difficult. It's rarely been done. It's relatively little data. Our kind of study here was dramatic, because it was traveler's diarrhea in reverse. I haven't said yet that among the volunteers, we had several hundred cases of diarrhea. And we isolated one Shigella and one Salmonella, plus 60 or 80 of these enteropathogenic coliform organisms from the volunteers and not from group control. So, no question that from the children, something went to the adults. What we are doing right now, Fred and I, we just finished a project in which we took the same coliform organism and subjected it to the new testing procedure. Most of you probably know that coliforms now can be looked at as being enterotoxigenic or invasive. Some coliforms invade into the mucosa, as does Shigella type A. Some coliforms produce an enterotoxin that behaves like cholera enterotoxin and causes profound diarrhea, but is not invasive. A third characteristic of some of the coliform organism of the enteropathogenic, the coli organism, is to be to enter the small bowel. Normally, except for the lowest part of the small bowel is without organisms. But one mode of pathogenicity for the endopathogenic coliforms is to invade the small bowel in the sense of going into the small bowel, as distinct from invasiveness, which is another characteristic, and third, as I said, the enterotoxigenicity. So, what Fred and I did, we took about two-thirds of the organisms isolated and subjected them to a variety of tests, adrenal cell tests, the rabbit ileo test, which are ways to check them on these other, these modes of new modes of pathogenicity. That's about where the field is at this time. You no longer use serologic testing as a criteria for pathogenicity. These new modes must be used, and it'll take some years, possibly, to show the impact of coliforms and enteroviruses on this diarrheal syndrome. In the meantime, just raised a really important question: what about being able to save, protect these kids while you're waiting for specific measures to come along Well, on the island of St. Lucia, a couple years ago, a friend of mine who became a health officer on the island for a 2-year period did a very simple thing. He set up marine hydration stations in a number of points, 4 or 5 sites around the island, and the death statistics from diarrhea in young children went from 150 per 1,000 per year down to 75 per 1,000 per year within months after starting the program. He took relatively untrained, unskilled women, showed them how to provide fluids, and that's all it took, just a rehydration station. If you added one more element to that, adequate nutrition, you would eliminate, where it would come down to probably 25 or lower. 25, 35, 40 grams. So it's feasible for all of you going out where we are to be highly effective by doing some simple things, such as setting up rehydration centers. And Dr. Devlin will be coming in during the third week here, our pediatrician, how he's burning in the tropics. So I'll give you his method of providing rehydration. I've got a couple of handouts showing more of his method and other methods. You should become keenly familiar with this method. One of the things that you yourself can do. Okay. Item 2, malnutrition. Maybe it's first in importance in terms of mortality. It's hard to be sure, obviously, but it's significant in terms of interaction with all the other diseases of great importance. For example, cholera. It's rare for a healthy person in North America or Europe to develop cholera. That's why we abandoned the requirement for vaccination for cholera. Both because the cholera vaccine isn't terribly good, and secondly, people who are healthy usually don't come down with severe diarrhea. With severe cholera. Just one example of the interaction between infectious agents and state of nutrition. There are many other examples, and I'm sure we'll be speaking about this again if we go on talking about the disease. It's just a smile that comes to mind. And I'll be elaborating at this point. Let me just throw it out now. In Puerto Rico, well, basically, our dilemma in treatment of schistosomiasis is that the drugs that we have are not very safe. And you're willing to accept a certain level of risk with the drug if the risk of the disease is very serious as well. But not long ago in Puerto Rico, the Public Health Department decided that no longer would it be permissible to use the antimalarial drug for treatment of schistosomiasis. Why? Because the disease in Puerto Rico is no longer of great pathologic importance. The level of infection had not changed dramatically, even though they had control programs. The number of people infected, the prevalence rates and the incidence rates for schistosomiasis was about the same as it was 20 years ago, but the disease did not proceed to the advanced stage of liver cirrhosis, of bleeding from esophageal varices, etc. What had happened? The load of parasites the individuals were carrying was down, and the nutrition was so much better. We know, although there's some proof for this as well, that good nutrition provides modest or excellent degree of protection for schistosomiasis. Last comment, perhaps in nutrition, that a very great interest now is the interaction between nutrition, physical development, and particularly mental development. It's obvious that state of nutrition relates to physical development. It's just so obvious in terms of stature and weight in many countries. Take Japan, where since the Second World War, there's been a constant increase in stature and size. And when I was walking street in Japan, or walk down the street in Singapore, it's peculiar to feel almost like a giant walking down the street in Singapore, which is how I felt. I'm not particularly tall in this country, but I was a head above most of the local people. When I went to Japan, just didn't have to go, things were changing. I was high above most of the population, except for the young man. And everywhere there were young Japanese men whose heads came up to about 6 feet high. And you've rather heard about that, but it's pretty quite true. They increased each generation. What's the latest theory on this? Is there anything better than the mother's pelvic bones being one of the limiting factors on the total size of the implant, plus the nutrition? Genetics aren't changing. Anyhow. But what's of more importance is the impact of nutrition on mental development. There's a lot of work going on in that area at the time. And maybe Dr. Wilson can elaborate this more when she comes, because she's going to talk on nutrition. Cardiovascular disease, we know, and the impact has been estimated at about 8 million per year. Tuberculosis, only in this instance, let me give you a prevalence in this instance. Tuberculosis prevalence estimated at about 30 million people infected with TB worldwide at any one moment in time. And the new cases, the incidence is about 3 million per year. What I've just done is use the loose way of speaking here. I give you absolute numbers rather than cancer. Deaths per year, about 2 million, pneumonia, 1 million. Malaria is now in the area of about 300,000. As you know, about 15 years ago, WHO had the hopes that they could eradicate malaria. At that time, 15 years ago, when the program began, there were about 2 million deaths per year, mostly in children, some in adults, and now down to about 300,000. It's just holding at that level or increasing as there are breakouts in places like Ceylon and India. I'm going to quickly come back to speaking about Oaxaca, state of Mexico, where I work. Oaxaca is one of the southernmost states in Mexico. And many have been to Mexico City, very advanced society. They have the people competence and the hospitals and facilities equal to what we have here in most respects. But you can go backwards in time in Mexico by going to Oaxaca, leaving the road system and marching back into the mountains, and to go back 100 years in time. In the towns where I work, I've never seen a physician before. The deaths in children is in the range of half dying by the age of 5. Let me elaborate about that a little bit more in just a moment. But I was talking about malaria, and that's what started this out. Malaria, it was spraying on the coast of Oaxaca for 15 years, and the spraying has been very popular for removing trichoma bugs, which deliver shock. So Chagas disease has stopped. They have not been successful in controlling malaria. But when I go down there every summer, I always carry morphine with me. I'm always treating local people and Americans and come down to Puerto Escondido, Puerto Montreal, even in Acapulco transmission malaria. It's really hard to control malaria, let alone eradicate it. That's why it hasn't yet worked. And probably can never work until we have vaccine. Accidents, one has to guess the role of accidents worldwide. I put it here in that third position. Measles, this figure is too high now, but in fact, measles is still high. It must be 100 to 200,000. Only smallpox is making a only four small plots, if you make a dramatic statement, that's going to disappear shortly. There still are a couple cases in Kenya. And it's Ethiopia, I think you told me, Kenya. Dr. Roberto, one of the last people around here to see smallpox, worked with WHO and CDC. CDC is Center for Disease Control in the United States. He is a member of the team in India when they finally controlled it there. He'll be coming in to talk to you this week on Friday. Smallpox will disappear in part because of what? I mean, obviously it's disappearing because there's a good vaccine.
There's no reservoir.
That's it. There's no reservoir. Mechanism. Supplemental cases there are. But the reason it can be controlled is that there's permanent immunity. Most cases are clinical and they can be recognized. The vaccine is a superb vaccine, and we now know how to adequately protect it under proper conditions. The jet gun facilitates immunizing large numbers of people, and of course, of fundamental importance, man is the only reservoir mechanism. There's no wild animal involved. By the way, what I didn't say this morning, I was trying to define tropical diseases, there's a great tendency here to include zoonotic